Welcome to A Day in the Why, where I talk with fascinating folks about the jobs they've held, the things they've learned, and how those fit in with their values and goals. You may just learn something, but I hope you'll at least laugh along with us as we dive into the mistakes we've made, the lessons we've learned, and the secrets behind the career curtain. Welcome to the latest episode of A Day in the Why. Today's guest is Joe Vangiri, a serial entrepreneur, music industry maven, and an early aficionado of the application of AI to the business of music.
Thank you.
I first became aware of Joe through his wife, Kathy, also an entrepreneurially minded Knoxvillian. Her work as an educator, editor, and publicist had led her work creating a children's app and original content for it, for which my then four-year-old daughter was a test user.
Yeah.
This wife and husband team caught my attention, and I've had them on my radar since. Joe started a series sharing pictures of his vinyl records on LinkedIn, and that was paired with fun historical trivia. That brought him back to mind as a possible guest. When I looked into his background a bit, I was convinced. Joe does not have a boring trajectory, nor one that rests on a massive stack of academic credentials. It sounds like you forged your own path.
Yeah, I did.
Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you.
I'm pretty excited about the show. It's the first one I'm recording from a location other than my own home studio.
Oh.
In fact, we're recording at your studio.
Yeah.
Maybe you can sketch a really quick background of who you are and what you've done in the music/music business scene over the years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, back in late 70s, I was playing in, when I got out of high school, of course. I was in bands my whole high school career. You know, I was a drummer. And then played in rock and roll, played what we would call classic rock today, and high school dances and so forth, YMCA dances. And then in college, I started playing in original punk rock bands. And I was a drummer in a band called The Reactors, played all the big places in New York, CBGBs, Gildersleeves, Max's Kansas City. We had some nice bills. We played a lot. And then I played in a new wave band after that called The Abstracts. One thing led to another. A buddy of mine was working over at CBS. He had a contract, well, EMI actually at the time. I was drumming for him, and I saw one of the first drum machines there. And I was fascinated by that technology. And from
what
then
year
on,
would that, what year would that have been?
This was 81.
Okay.
1981 was an Oberheim drum machine. Was one of the lesser gods of the drum machine. It wasn't the Lin or the 808. It was Oberheim, which was a big German synthesizer company. Great piece of gear. I was no longer needed as a session drummer once that happened for songwriters because they just want to etch out what they do. And back in the old days, you would actually have a full band play all your demo songs all the time. Now, today, it's all done electronically, like in my studio. We do drums, everything electronically. And then from there, I became a DJ. I started DJing. I DJed for most of my life, and then I started working for, Kathy and I got married, and I started working for a company, KBI Systems. We sold broadcast equipment in New York. So cameras, one-inch recorders, and then Betacam came out of selling Betacam, Laserdisc. And there was this thing from Japan I used to get before the internet was fanzines. I don't know if your listeners they may remember what a fanzine was, but geeks like us, music geeks, would print fanzines at night on the copiers about the subject that you liked. It was kind of like a blog, I guess.
Yeah.
It would be today.
With like limited geographical dispersion.
Yeah. And it was literally pad. If you got your hands on one, it was like worth gold. It was like important because guys would, and I'm saying guys, and I mean, I'm from Jersey and I'm 63, so men and women would share them. And
right.
We would share them in the office. And one was called the Video Disc Monitor. I remember the title. Fun thing in from Japan, karaoke. Pioneer was going to bring karaoke, and this was 1986. And I said, wow, that's pretty cool. So I called up Pioneer, and I called up my contact there. I said, hey, this karaoke, can I get my hands on? And I was the number three Laserdisc salesman in America. I was
moving. So you had some cred.
Yeah, I had some cred, especially on the broadcast side. And they said, sure. And I got it, and I brought it to my father's Italian-American club. Oh, we're not going to like this. I don't know. My Uncle Sal comes up to me. Got any Sinatra? Oh, yeah, yeah. Got any Dean Martin, Red? And all his buddies come up. 3 o'clock in the morning, I said, I'm leaving. And then what happened was, my wife and I, we looked at it, and we said, well, let's buy a few of the machines, and we'll rent them out to bars. And that's what we ended up doing. We rent them to bars and restaurants. And this is 87. By the time we were done, we had 60 establishments going. And it was a logistics nightmare. Because this is before cell phones.
It didn't scale well.
No, it didn't scale well. And it was great pay, because back in the old days, what I would do is 1/15th the cost of equipment would be a daily rental. So if it cost me $1,000, 15% of that, that's what you're going to pay. And then Kathy had a great idea. Let's go to the college, the local colleges, Montclair State, William Patterson up in New Jersey. And we said, let's get some of the people from the drama department and music theater. And we have them run the shows. And that's what we did. I mean, we kind of mapped out the very first karaoke hosts. And our concept was Mickey Mouse Club for adults. Make everybody happy.
Okay. So you identified some drama department people as a way to help you scale the idea and the implementation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which we eventually sold all of the machines to all the people that worked for us. Long
after they paid themselves off.
Yeah. It was great. It was a great little business. And that was... We did that 87 through about 92, 93, and then my godfather, literally my godfather, called me up and said, hey, what do you know about the internet? And this is 94, and I was in Philly at the time.
Okay.
And I had a studio in Philadelphia. We were doing a boutique studio doing high-end boardrooms. It was like the touchscreens before people knew what a touchscreen was. It was this big corporation.
And that was a lot of the way that you kind of flexed back in the day.
Back in the day. Yeah, that's how you did it. And we were doing, and then I got involved in distance learning. I was part of the PAECT, Pennsylvania Association of Education Communication Technologies. I can't believe I'm remembering this. And, well, Pennsylvania is the most rurally populated state in the union. And you could be in a town with 1,000 people. You're not going to get the German teacher in your town. You're not going to get good science in your town. You're not going to get, any.
Right.
So we started in distance learning, and I was doing that. And that's how I had the background. When my godfather called me, I said, yeah, I'm doing this thing over the internet at the time. And we're doing video streaming. It's really cool. You got to see it. Okay, I'll come down. So he came down to Philadelphia. He talked to me. He said he had the scientists from Israel at the time, Aaron Friedman. And they were starting this company, Fortress Technologies, which is a big company now. And I was the first salesman.
And that was the security industry?
Security, it was cryptography.
Okay.
It was my background. And I had to get this thing through the NSA, the National Security. This is before the war.
Yeah.
94 through 99, I'm there.
Were they as up to speed as you were, or did you kind of have to educate them in order for them to evaluate?
Oh, no. Literally, the colonels for the Joint Chiefs of... I mean, I got to go into the Pentagon, which was the coolest thing ever in the entire world for me. I thought it was great. I love America. I just really, it's like that my goosebumps, like, because they're the best and the brightest that are working there. I mean, they could have done other things in life to make more money, and they chose to serve the public good. So to me, that's like honor. And they were wicked smart, and explaining Diffie-Hellman key exchange to someone back in the day. I think the encryption was 512. Because we weren't allowed to go over it legally. And then
they retained over that for government.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Oh, then we implemented IDEA within the government, and which was International Data Encryption Algorithm, which was like verboten for citizens. Like, you couldn't use it. PGP was based on it originally. He was doing DES at the time, triple DES. Who was that? Zimmerman. He went to jail for it.
Yeah.
For PGP, remember? Pretty good privacy.
And he basically gave government level encryption to the common man.
Yeah. Which was great. We have it all day long now with some of the different VPNs. Mm-hmm. We created the term VPN when I was at, it's hysterical, but virtual private network. I took that from PBXs. In telephony, I had no way to explain it. I was at, what was it called? Oh my God, I was in Vegas, and it was like 1996. Interop was the name of it was part of CES. And I'm pitching this thing called a VPN, and everyone's laughing at me. No one's going to use the internet to communicate over. I'm like, no, they are. We're doing stuff right now with video and stuff with the government. And I'm trying to explain it, and these engineers are just shredding me because I'm a salesman. I'm not an engineer. Right. Why are you calling it a VPN? Well, in PBXs at the time for telephony in buildings, it was a virtual private network within the PBX.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Fortress originally coined the term VPN. They never patented it. And I was the first gagoots, Italian word for squash, a term of endearment. I was the first gagoots to even say it out loud in front of people. And so I've been in the thick of it with technology my whole life. And then having to learn it, like to be a salesman, in order to really sell something, you really have to study it. Like, in order to really sell it.
Well, it's interesting. The idea of a paradigm shift typically means you've got one mental model that's moving to another that has some similarities, some overlap.
Oh, yeah.
And when it's adopted at first, it's adopted right at the edge of that correlation, right?
Yeah.
And so the VPN, I didn't realize that it was a correlation to telephony,
yeah.
to the idea of a virtual telephonic network.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah. It was from a PBX, and it was an old term, and we dug it out. And then we had these big boxes. Oh, my God. And then we went through this thing called SPOC, Security Proof of Concept Keystoning. And probably, when you say regrets, probably the only regret I had at the time, Larry McGinnis, God rest his soul, who was a wonderful guy, and he was at the NSA, and we just had a great, he was like a father figure to me. He was really great. And I was older. I was no spring chicken. I was in my 30s. He was like 35 then in 87. No, I was 37. I was 38. And I was 38 years old, and this guy was just great. And he's like, "Hey, Joe, we vetted you. Would you consider coming to work as the NSA, as you know, to speak for us?" And I was like, "You know, I thought I was going to make millions with Fortress." And I was like, "Well, I got all the stock before, yeah, but this is the country, and you get to say it." And then I think probably the bigger reason why was we'd have to live, and everything we did would be under major scrutiny, and
right.
every call, any conversation I had. And I, you know, and I should have probably just realized then that that was going to happen to me anyway, to all of us anyway. And that was probably one regret, not going for that job at the time, because I would have came in at the top of government pay-wise and stuff.
Sure.
Would have been great for me. But I decided to pass on it. But then I was so frustrated working there, because it was a suit, blue suit with the red tie every day, and
yeah.
the leather shoes. And I'm a musician, and I'm like a fish out of water. It got to me. And I said to my godfather, who was at the company, he's like, "Well, they want to make you, you know, CEO over here at Fortress." And I'm like, I got this DJ software. I found this guy, Jorgen Hedberg. And Jorgen, if you're listening, I love you. great guy. And Jorgen was in Sweden, Luleå, Sweden, which is like, I think, 30 kilometers from the Arctic Circle. And this young man, he was younger than me, and he wrote the first code, the very first code for DJ software. Then he called it the SL1200. and the 1200 was a famous turntable. Techniques 1200.
Yeah.
Techniques 1200. I knew I'd get there eventually. And I go, "Oh, well, how many beta testers do you have?" "Oh, 15,000. I said, "That's not beta testers. That's users at this point."
Right.
I said, "You're in Luleå, huh?" I said, "If I send you a ticket, will you come down to Florida?" "Yeah." So he came down to Florida. We sat. We negotiated. I acquired his technology. We came to work as partners together. We went out and raised, oh my gosh, $15 million. And then we made two versions of that product. Then we had a professional version and a consumer version of the DJ software. And we're the first people. And I remember another time speaking in front of a group, 1999, August, at the DJ Expo in Atlantic City. And I'm up there telling them they're going to be using a computer. And it was like pitchforks and torches coming out.
Yeah, instead of the purely mechanical and the hard media.
Yeah. And these guys were, most of them, the mobile DJs were CDs. But the purest club guys were still vinyl.
Sure.
And at the time, I had a vinyl record label. I had a label called Subsonic. We were doing a type of music out of Florida called breakbeat. And I was doing 12-inch vinyl singles at the time. That's why I love vinyl. I mean, I'm a vinyl enthusiast still.
Right.
But I saw this technology coming. I'm like, you know, there's this thing called Winamp. And it's going to happen. It was right as MP3.com came out. But Napster, we were contacted by them early on. They wanted to, because Napster, they were users of PC DJ. And they were users of the SL1200 back from when Jorgen was doing it. Because Jorgen started doing this in like 90.
They were part of that 15K originals.
Yeah. Like he was doing it like in 94, 95. So the guys from Napster wanted to be the search field in it. So DJs can add songs to there and share songs with each other. In 1999, one of the fellows who joined my board of directors was Nile Rodgers, and he's a famous producer, still a famous guy, beautiful guy. I mean, he was the band Chic, Freak Out, Madonna, Like a Virgin, We Are Family. I mean, he's got over 300 million albums sold in his lifetime, produced David Bowie's Let's Dance. I mean, just stellar career, man. It was just an angel to me that came into my life. It was great. I mean, we did work with the Bungie studio with him, with Halo. We did the Halo mashup mixer. We distributed 3 million of those online. And it was who could do the best mix. And we were doing stems, breakdowns of songs where people can remix them. And we did that with PC DJ way back when, and with Halo. Oh my gosh, what was that, 2001 or 2000?
So wait, you brokered an arrangement with Microsoft then, to use some of their intellectual music property in order to lend it out to people so they could do remixes?
No. What we did was a promotion for Halo. And they used our software. And the artist that, because Nile produced the a lot of the music, like Breaking Benjamin and a few other, Steve Vai was on it, a few other people. But Nile was doing the music for Bungie. And Nile brought me up there. I said, hey, guys, how about you do a promotion? For me, I just wanted to give away software because I was running advertising inside the software. I ran ad banners and buttons.
Okay.
This is before streaming. This is before high-speed internet. This is that. We were in Seattle in the Microsoft campus.
Okay.
We're on the Microsoft campus, and it was wonderful. And they did this giveaway, and it was great for us because it got us 3 million users. And then on my board was Matthew Broffman. His big brother, Edgar, ran Universal at the time. And we went into Universal Music Group, and we did enhanced CDs.
I remember those.
Yeah, well, we were one of the first guys to do them. I mean, we came up with this. We put our PC DJ software in there. And we would put all the songs in MP3 that were on the CD inside the PC DJ. So if you put it in your computer, it would boot up and you'd be able to mix the album.
But if you put it in a regular CD player, it would just find the WAV files and just play those sequentially normally, yeah.
It was a great thing. And we did like about 8 CDs. Oh my gosh, we got up to 13 million installs of our product. We had 3 million active daily users. We were generating about $17,000 a day in advertising. I was the happiest guy in the world. I mean, I had this little company in Clearwater, Florida. We took in $10 million in investment. We were on our way, man. This is 2000. This one's really painful. So it's 2000, and we're going to set up studios in Seoul, Korea, and we've got a great partner there because our underwriter was a company called Lehman Brothers at the time, and they were one of the big shots on Wall Street at the time, Lehman Brothers. And okay, they're going to give me a bridge into an initial public offering that year, and they're going to put a valuation on my company of $600 million back then. I mean, it's like, wow. It's hard to like imagine it and like, there's probably people right now saying, oh, he's full of donkey dust. But no, it's the truth. I mean, this is where we were at. And then we're open. Then the Lehman Brothers associate in Seoul, they came to Clearwater, Florida. And we were putting this thing together. They did like 3 trips. And they had anime company. And we're going to do all the music for it with the DJ software. Everything's flying. We even had the Nile Rodgers MP3 Dance Club, which was one of the first metaverses. And it was a 3D virtual world that you got a figure that you would run and you would be able to chat to somebody. It was chat. You had to type though.
Sure.
And you would chat to another
person.
But
it was a virtual space.
It was a virtual space. It was early on.
And it was tied to a very thematic.
Yeah. So anyone who doesn't believe me, just go Google MP3, Nile Rodgers MP3 Dance Club, and you'll read the article in Billboard magazine that year.
We'll link it in the show notes.
Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes. So we did that as well. And like, we were going great guns. I'm like, wow, we have this IPO. I mean, the Lehman Brothers guys would tell me, well, we're going to have to take some of your stock, Joe, and we're going to have to give it, but you know, it's going to be worth like $20 million to you. And I'm like, oh, gee, shucks, you know, that's terrible. And I'm looking at luxury submarines, joke, but you know, I mean,
your own missile silo.
I'm the happiest guy in the world. I'm like, wow, this is great. So March of 2000, very important March of 2000, everybody flies in, everybody's got the Armanis on with our logos on their t-shirts to inform me they're pulling the investment because the internet bubble has burst in Asia. You know when the involuntary muscles on your back start to shake? It was like a scene out of a movie. Like, I mean, years later, I saw this movie with Ashton Kutcher where this happens to him in the movie. Like, happened to me in real life, though. Like, this, like, really happened. We had a party ready for we're going to get a $20 million bridge that week. And they told me they're pulling the bridge. I had all of the payroll on my personal app. We were out of money. I had that on my Amex card. So financially, I was in ruin.
Wow.
Ruin. And I had 97 employees, 100,000 square
feet. You were holding the bag.
I was the left holding the bag. It was horrible. I said, please don't steal stuff on the way out. You know, the record division, I said, guys, I'm going to sell you off. Don't do anything stupid. We're going to sell it. And we ended up selling to this fella, Steve from Miami. I forget his last name. But anyway, I sold my record company off to get some money to keep the software company alive. And 97 people went down to 12 that next Monday. And I said, guys, I have no idea how I'm going to pay you. Like I'm in tears almost the whole time. It was like, I'm 40 years old now at this point. So it's rough on me. I've got 2 young children at home and Kathy. I came home to Kathy to tell her that night. Mm. And she goes, just tell me you have a plan. I said, I have a plan. I mean, I literally remember going outside and throwing up every morning. I had nervous stomach so bad. As I would throw the ball to the dog smoking 6 packs of cigarettes, I was a nervous wreck. I'll tell you what, that team, God was good. Like, everyone pulled together really hard. Then we ended up turning PC DJ around. And like when you're down, everybody wants to kick you, to the point where we had a deal with this company, Newmark, and he was doing the right thing. I mean, the fellow who had that at the company at the time said, look, let me just buy you out of bankruptcy if you come work for me. And I'm like,
Newmark, they had the equipment,
the mixers. All the DJ. And,
yeah, yeah.
Well, we did a deal with Newmark where we designed, we took the double CD controller and made a serial. It was before USB. We made a serial controller for our DJ software, and we called it the DAC-1, Digital Audio Controller 1. It was the very first control surface for disc jockeys. Yeah, there's a lot of firsts in this talk on technology. It's pretty wild, and it's like Forrest Gump kind of stuff. It's, you know, we were laughing. Kathy and I were just laughing of all the touches we've had with these things.
Well, you seem kind of like you're a technical soothsayer. Or seer.
Schmuck would probably be more like it.
That's the Italian word for seer, right?
That would be the Yiddish part. That would be the Russian-Jewish half of me. You look at all these things, and you start going through these technology dives, and we were looking at the software at the time. I was like, how do we save this company? And, you know, we made that hardware piece in with the DAC-1, and Newmark was distributing it, and it was in Guitar Center. And they were selling for $399. And, you know, I met with the guy, Jack, and he wanted to do this thing. And I said, nah, I really don't want to do that. And he said, okay, I'm going to discount, I'm going to ruin you. I'm going to sell your controller for $40 at all the Guitar Centers starting Monday. I said, okay. And I know there's 2,000 of them sitting in the stores at all the Guitar Centers. I flew home from Rhode Island. I got back to Clearwater. I'm broke. I mean, I am broke as a joke. So I got to call up friends and family and say, give me your credit card. I need your credit card right now. I got to go buy every single one of these controllers from Guitar Center. My daughters, my wife, my friend, we all got on phones. We bought everyone from every Guitar Center and had them shipped.
At the $40 price point?
At the $40 price point. Okay. Cheaper than I can make them a year later.
Right.
So they're at $40 and I bought 2,000 of them. We brought them back to our warehouse in Clearwater, Florida. And we turned around and we sold them for $500 and we did
you
it all offline.
You bought the freaking market.
I bought the market. I had to. I had no choice. Yeah. Survival. I mean, it's like, I was a wreck. I mean, I was going to be ruined. I would have been ruined if I didn't do this. And I brought them all in, and then we were able to get up enough money to get a line of credit then to start manufacturing. And that's when I did I had to start manufacturing in Taiwan. Kent Johannesson. Kent, if you're listening, yay, thumbs up, Kent. Kent came, and he's the fellow who designed the first DAC-1 for me, and he designed the DAC-2 and then subsequently the DAC-3, which was the first big whoopee scoop. It had all sorts of features in it on the software. But, you know, manufacturing in Taiwan was really interesting as well. And I got my first taste of because I originally wanted to make it in America. I was like, no, we got to make this in America. And I remember going to J-Bill Circuit right there in Tampa. And J-Bill came back $128. I'm like, guys, I could get this made for $62 in China. Well, make it in China.
Right.
I was like, really? Yeah. I'm like, damn, I really didn't want to do it. I was like made in America. Like my father was a steel worker. I watched how that industry got taken, destroyed. And I'm like, I really wanted to make it here. I couldn't.
Right.
It was impossible. So we made it in Taiwan. I did a trip to Taiwan. Met with Yehorn. It was the name of the factory. And they were great. And I subsequently became really good friends with the factory. You know, we did runs and we sold out the DAC-2 and then we did the DAC-3, which was our second iteration. And PC DJ is still in business. They're still, I'm associated with them now. Because what happened before I came up here to Knoxville in 2010, the fellow who was the chairman of D1 came and I had a call center. I was running a call center and I was doing a bunch of internet advertising, acai berry, lose weight, blah, 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 all these 14-day. And I felt horrible about doing that stuff. I mean, it was like terrible kind of marketing. I mean, you're doing everything ethically. It's all above board, but you know that your end user is not reading anything.
Yeah.
You know they're not. And I just couldn't keep my head on my pillow.
You're not contributing to advancing the human species, right?
No, you're not. It really bothered me, but I had to survive. I said, Bill, I hate what I'm doing at the time. And this fellow, Bill O'Callaghan, was just a great guy in my life. He goes, help me get revenue up back at PC DJ again. I said, okay. Then we were looking at it, and his biggest selling software, I go, Bill, your biggest selling software is your karaoke. You need more karaoke content to sell more. And then we ended up calling the company Chartbusters, which was up here at the time. That my studio previously was called Chartbuster Tennessee Production Center. And he was in a bunch of trouble, the fella. And he let me know. He goes, Joe, it was a mess. It was a dog's breakfast. He got caught at the sea change when it went from CD to digital. And everybody was stealing his stuff. And he didn't have a streaming site up yet. And
was it lost money or potential revenue?
Oh, no, real money. Like okay. he was probably doing about 10 to 12 million a year in CD sales. It went down to like four. And you try managing 50-something people with $4 million, it's hard. I mean, just salaries, you're not going to make it. You know, I came up as the consultant, and the consultant, at the time when I was consulting, you know, you would go and consult with a lot of companies. The first thing you'd have to tell them is like, you got to get rid of a lot of the family. You got all this family hanging out here doing nothing. I would go interview people. Oh, what do you do here? And write down what they do. And then I would go ask them, what does he do here? Write that. And I would compare the two. And 9 out of 10 times, they were not even on the same sheet of music together. And so we did all this consulting, went through everything. That pared that company back to about 8 people when I first got up here in 2012. And then we bootstrapped it. 2 of the fellows that were investors in it stayed. And they said, okay, we'll ride this out with you. And that's what we did. We got the karaoke company up and going. We had a bunch of issues with publishing, and I had a straight, and that takes forever to clean up the name. And it took me years to clean up the name. And I cleaned it all up, so we're above board. I mean, I had to clean up the sins of the past. And it wasn't sins, intentional sins. It was when the sea changed happened, when it went from traditional to digital, all these
whole new rights management systems came into play.
Yeah, it was I think the Yiddish word for it, mishagas, a real mess. It was a royal mess. And we had to clean it up, and it's taken us years. And we've got a great service now. We service people on the karaoke side. We have AWS servers, Amazon servers with APIs to other people's software. We're not a marketing company.
Sure.
We're a technology
music
company. So we deliver music, and we have 18,000 karaoke tracks here. So, well, I should say note perfect. One thing this company's done tremendously is fantastic recordings. I mean, you can hear our stuff on Karaoke on Vivo. It's free. We have a subscription site now that we built called Karaoke on Demand. It's an OTT site. It works on Roku, Amazon Fire, Apple TV. Our team built that. My wife, Kathy, who you know, she basically runs that component as the COO of our karaoke business. And that's growing. The pandemic.
I was going to say, content is king.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll tell well, when the pandemic hit 2 years ago, talk about, it couldn't happen to a better guy. I mean, I was ready for
disaster. Been through the disaster wave.
60% of our revenue comes from bars and restaurants. 60. At the time, there's 24 people here at the beginning of the pandemic. Now I ride or die with automation. And that's not my line. Ryan Scher over at PC DJ wrote this the other week, and I said, wow, that's so relevant. I ride or die.
I'm going to use that.
I said, Brian, I'm going to use that. What was that? Is this 5 cents every time you use it? Okay. I said, I ride and die. And we really do. We ride and die by automation now. I mean, everything we do is automation. 5 years ago, since I was here, getting back to Neil Zammel, and we did Enhance ED for Fabulous. And I met this one fella, Neil Zammel, who was the CFO. Oh, God, I think it's Elektra or Arista. I'm going to mess it up. But whatever Fabulous record label it was at the time, he was the CFO at that label. And we became friends. And we stayed friends over the years. And he always seen me with technology. So he reached out to me 5 years ago and said, hey, I've got this wonderful piece of software this young man created. And he goes, you have to see it. The fellow that owns it is this fellow, Amos Fakahani, a really great guy, was president of Merrill Lynch, like real guy, like nice man too, like real family guy, like really nice man. And he's a big restaurateur now. The software turned out his nephew developed, who is a super genius, Marcus Matusiak, 16 years old, Oregon scholar, Leeds Cathedral, plus the choir master, and he got tutored by Cambridge and Oxford professors would come, and Marcus lived in a cell with the monks. Like, he got a cell. If people don't know, a cell is your room if you're a monk.
Right.
They call them cells.
No possessions to speak of.
No, nothing. There's nothing in it, and it's just you, whatever you're working at, your books. And Marcus wasn't even Catholic. So Marcus, when he was there, started to write out the code for counterpoint. He wanted to do Bach challenges. And Marcus is a big chess guy. And so he said, oh, let me start writing code, genetic algorithms, evolutionary algorithms, and genetic code.
So it takes in a seed of some sort and then produces a...
Will mutate.
Yeah, okay.
So stock. So if you're a chess player, I think it's Stockfish. I forget which one. Training. And that's an AI. That's an expert system. I mean, it'll pass the Turing test on, can it analyze and create music? It's not going to have a conversation with you.
Sure.
How you doing, Joe? But
a form of human expression.
It's a form of human expression. Our big differentiator is how we communicate to the AI. How do you communicate? It's like, do you rub the lamp? I mean, it always turned out bad for everyone who rubbed the lamp when the genie came. It always turned out bad. And I know a few other AI companies that are neural nets, what are weighted systems, and they work fine for certain things. But in creativity, a great book to read, Escher Goodell Bach. I recommend it for everyone. It's a real easy read.
I've got it. I would dispute that statement.
Oh my gosh. It's how you interact with the AI. And it's taken us 5 years and we've come out with a product we call Creator, KR38R. It's Leet Speak, the three is an E, Creator. We came out with this Creator Pro where we use music theory to communicate with the AI as well. Mm-hmm. And music theory is consistent and congruent with every university around the world. And that project is really taken off. We hold 7 patents, not patent pending. Actually, we hold 7 patents granted. And these patents are built on building blocks. Think Legos. Mm-hmm. At the time, for tracking the digital rights for the composition. So this is heavy stuff. And this is very difficult to explain. And I'll go super slow. There's 2 sides to all music. Music is both a master recording, that which would be on a record or a CD or a digital stream. That's mm-hmm. their master recording. That's the purview of record labels. And then there's the underlying IP, intellectual property, which are the words and music. And the words and music are held by publishers. Publishers, that's one half of it. So the two halves together are a song. Like in our karaoke business, we're the record label because we recorded it. That's the master recording. We have to go out and get the licenses from publishers, and that's called a video synchronization license, which is not statutory nor compulsory. You have to ask for them, and then they grant them to you at a certain rate, which is usually MFN, Most Favored Nation, with whatever the industry standards. I think we're at 20% now, go back to publishing. We know a lot about tracking intellectual property because we have to pay every quarter our publishing rights, and we have 246 publishers right now in our karaoke business, which is cumbersome. I mean, that's a lot of publishers. And we're constantly clearing new songs, getting the synchronization rights. That means to clear a song, getting the synchronization right to use it. Because I can't put it up on the internet or on TV. Like TV, we service Music Choice nationally. And they have a TV channel, a karaoke channel on Music Choice. And all of the music on there is us. We service almost all of the top karaoke hardware companies, software companies that do on the professional side. We went after the professional market because we knew that from my previous incarnation with PC DJ. It really, the skill set that we learned from karaoke was perfect for the AI business because my concerns were, how do we track all these rights? Well, there's no rights really. Explain that to me. Well, we don't use any of the notes. We don't use any of the chords. It's like not a Markov sequence or we're not chopping things up or spitting it back in like the same notes or not even using samples from music. We're literally putting notes on paper. We work in a format called MIDI, Music Instrument Digital Interface, MIDI. And MIDI 2 is all that. It's amazing.
And that's been around forever.
Yeah. Well, now MIDI 2 is like the new iteration of it. And now we can assign it to any VST, any virtual instrument or any virtual musician. We can assign the MIDI code from our software. And the Creator Pro is our first iteration of the AI we're bringing out. We're like, how do we track all of this intellectual property? Now, because I really think that the metadata is important, like super important when I'm creating. It's going to get to the point where I can analyze Led Zeppelin. So I analyze Led Zeppelin. I've analyzed Led Zeppelin. Does Led Zeppelin own what I've analyzed of them? Because now it's like
now you get the music and you have the analysis.
I have the analysis, but I'm not using any of their music. So now here's Led Zeppelin's analysis. It would be nice. I use Led Zeppelin. I could use Fabulous or anybody. I mean, Bach, but he wouldn't care right now because he's pretty dead. Led Zeppelin would really care. So, like, how do I track all this? How do I do that attribution to the artist? And is the artist...
The rights holder.
The rights holder. But he's no longer the rights holder because now everything has been analyzed and now it's writing new music as if you were that person. So I could take any song and write a song. It would be boring, but I can learn from one song with our AI. In other neural nets, you have to use hundreds of thousands of songs.
So let me stop you for a second and see if I understand this. You're saying that basically the way that you might use AI, the Creator Pro, mm-hmm. is to have it listen or analyze, let's say Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, song.
And then turn around and have it start to output, to make something, to create something.
Yeah.
and it would have used the seeds or the inputs from Led Zeppelin in order to do that. And you're saying that the issue that you're trying to, one issue you're trying to solve is how to do rights attribution for the genesis, the seed inputs?
Yeah. Like the minute you hit the metaverse of AI, like you're now in the brain. So I've learned, like a human, I learned how to play the drums. I listened to Charlie Watts, Ringo Starr, Keith Moon, Ginger Baker, and I played like all of them. I used pieces of everything and I mixed them together. Now it's mine. I got my own style and I played my own way, but a lot of it had to do with certain things they did. Like I know what I'm using.
You're talking about influence.
Yeah. So, influence.
You know, if you play drums and you learn from Keith Moon, that doesn't mean that Keith Moon owns my drum. Done, right?
Exactly. Same thing with the AI. I'm happy you said that because it takes me a long time to get there with people. Just like a person, it's going to iterate how it's going to iterate. And it's going to mutate up against music theory. So like in a game with AI, especially with a genetic algorithm, you would mutate up against win, lose, draw, right?
Okay.
Completely objective.
Right.
Music is so subjective. However, music theory is not subjective. It's objective. It's it's music theory. And that's what our patents are on as well. Marcus did an amazing job. And then I was introduced to another young visionary, this fellow Charles Cording, God's been good. I mean, it's like, or the author of the universe, how I like to call it, has been really good to me because Charles came into my life and dissected Marcus's patents and did the attributions to blockchain. And he understood how near and dear to me it was for us to give credit to the artist, because I think they should get credit or they're going to be forgotten. And even if it's used in artificial intelligence, even if we're making new work, well, I think they should get a percentage.
Give credit where credit is due. But that's not to say that it's rights.
No.
Different entirely.
Different entirely. So in our world, okay, what would be the benefit of me going to these major artists and saying, hey, I want to do a deal with you? And I figured it out. It would be name and likeness. If I'm going to use your name and likeness, you should get paid.
Right.
So what we've put together.
And it's honor, not obligation.
It's honor. Oh, yeah. No, it's honor. This is 100% honor. As musicians, they say honor amongst thieves. It's honor amongst musicians. Mm-hmm. And it's how do we do that attribution? Because you may say, hey, I love this Jimi Hendrix guitar. I like the way Jimi approached the guitar. So we analyzed Jimi Hendrix guitar. And now we have, in the AI, there's a feature set of Jimi Hendrix analyzed guitar lines.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, how Jimi would approach a solo. Or how Jimi would approach writing a line. It'll be new music. It'll be new work completely. But it'll have the feel of Jimi Hendrix.
And not only the feel of Jimi Hendrix, but in all of the into perpetuity. Any time that output, that particular song is used, credit to Jimi will be embedded in the blockchain,
in our blockchain.
Ledger.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
In the big, for anyone out there, a ledger is like Bob Cratchit in the sky.
So it's a permanent record that everyone shares. Anyone who uses the ledger, uses the blockchain, the cryptocurrency, the record, anyone who uses it has a copy of it. It cannot be erased. Yep. It cannot be destroyed unless there's a, you know, nuclear event.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, and if it's on the internet, which was designed for nuclear events, it would be fine. The reality for us is, how do I go to market with this? You know, we were like, early on, can it do this? Can it do that? Yeah, it could do it all. So the first thing people said, well, how do you know what you're writing doesn't infringe? Well, I said, it very well may. Like, we're going to write like that person. So what we're writing, we may write the same thing he wrote already. So we come up with a technology within it. We call it Music Factor Reports. And what we did was we analyzed 10 of the top court cases. I have it online, and we'll put the link to it. It's called Music Factor Reports. And I took all the top court cases and we do a musicology grade report on the similarities. We went to all of the top law firms in New York, Joel Katz, I mean, Fox, Davis Shapiro, all the big guys. And hey, what's an infringement? Well, that's a court thing. Oh, you know, there's certain law, but it's a court thing. So, yeah, but we can show you the actual similarities, like the percentages. You know, if it's not in the 90 percentile and the intent wasn't there, and that's why it's got to go to court, because it's the intent.
Mm-hmm.
Did they sit in a room and say, hey, we got to make something that sounds just like David Bowie's blah, blah, blah? Well, you're ripping David Bowie off because you sat in a room and you're saying you want it to sound like that.
Right.
You know, that's one thing. Like, the reason why they lost that Blurred Lines case, because they were verbose about it. Yeah, of course it's got the Marvin Gaye. We're trying, you know, it's like, well, it really wasn't. I mean, melody-wise, it really isn't. I mean, rhythm-wise, yeah, it is. Is the rhythm that copyrightable? I mean, I don't think so. I mean, but the melody certainly is. And it wasn't the melody, but the court decided in the Marvin Gaye case towards Marvin Gaye estate because of the intent, not
right.
Like in the case of Led Zeppelin, you know, everybody was saying, "Oh, it sounds." It doesn't. It's not. I mean, look at the. You go to my site, read the reports. I mean, you'll see it. We wanted to put that in there because you may want. That's called derivative work. You may want to do derivative work. If I'm say, hey, I want to make unique music to give out to 10,000 people my song, and I want everyone to have just a little bit different of that song. Or you're working on a movie, and you want the thematic of the movie to be similar.
Now I know where you're going with the NFTs.
Yeah. Well, I was approached by a famous, I can't probably say any names, I was approached by a famous manager for a big-time producer who had a really big hip-hop song. And they said to me, because they were pitching Dapper Labs, and Dapper was doing the NBA Hot Shots. And they came to me and said, hey, can you give us 10,000 iterations of this? Right. So we did. And we gave them, we didn't do 10,000. We did 10 for the demo just to show them. The producer, big guy, was gobsmacked. He loved it. He goes, Joe, this is great. NBA, unfortunately, didn't pick up his song. But to me, I was like,
it's a perfect concept.
Perfect concept. This is proof of concept for me. I was like, this is great, and it works. I'll share it with you so you can hear it. But it really was amazing what we did. I'm like, oh my gosh. So I started reaching out to all these NFT and hedge funds and so forth, started talking, mixed it up in music. And we really have created something amazing. It's like in stealth mode right now. We've been working on it for, and I'll share a video with you to watch because I want to get your input on it separate and apart from this. But it's real interesting. And the ability now, because each one of our AI mixes, we're like, what do we put it into for consumers? So we created a consumer app called Creator, and you could get it on the App Store on Apple. It's only in Apple. We just didn't have the file. We like 4 years ago, we raised $2 million. Sounds like a lot of money, but it's not.
Not
in software. And with $2 million, we built out all of the karaoke API infrastructure and everything, which is generating, we're cash flow positive. The company's making more money than it's burning. We're able to develop too at the same time, which is just wonderful. We've been self-funding now,
right?
Because of that $2 million, and that was a strategy I took. People really get confused. Well, you got a karaoke company, and it's like it's all music technology.
The Creator app, that's only a consuming application.
That one right now is consuming and creation. You can create your own mix of it. Like you'll see, we call it the beat pad, and it's a 3x4 grid. Gives you 3 drum selections. 3 bass selections, 3 melody selections, and 3 special effects, whether it's a vocal from the artist, if the artist wants, the artist that's working with us.
If they opted in,
If they opted in and they wanted to use that. And then there's different rights for each little of those blocks. Each of those loops have a different right associated to them.
Oh, wow.
And we track it all with the blockchain. That's the only way we can track it.
Right.
All of those independent loops. And then when you go from 3, you could slide it and it adds another 3 drums and then another 3 drums. And each one of those are different. And each one of those unique loops. But when you take the first 3x4 grid and it makes 256 potential combinations. One combination being nothing, which is the ghost combination, which is the most rare and valuable. The ghost combination. The ghost is the key to the song because that would be the master rights holder. It's nothing, but it's that song. It's silence. The first artist that we're engaging for an NFT was a project our visionary Charles Cording did for his college thesis. And it was an anthropological study of hip hop. And it was music as a weapon. A song is a bullet on the charts. That's what they call a song that rises on a chart. So Charles used a 50 caliber bullet, the 3D graphic. He's working with a high-end design firm that does 3D graphic animation, and he's a sketch artist, and he drew it all out, and they're designing it in three. It's amazing. I'll send you I have an AR of it I can show you. We're on a podcast, so it'd be silly for me to show you now, but I'll show you. And it's I can make the bullet pop up right here in the room in front of us and spin around, and I could 3D print it. Each one of the bullets of the 256 will be unique that you can collect.
Okay, so there's a token.
There's a token.
A unique 50 caliber bullet token that goes along with each of these iterations of the track.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're each non-fungible tokens, NFTs. It hasn't launched yet. This is launching hopefully in the next 90 days if we can really get our act together.
There's a lot of stuff going on in the – do you know Kevin Rose?
No.
Founded Dig way back in the day, but he's really been on top of super passionate about the NFT space and about genuine artisanship in the space versus just the money-making aspect, right? That's a side effect. It's the fact that we have this ability for creatives, for musicians, for artists to really, A, monetize and actually make a living for themselves finally. But it's a way to sort of permanently keep and record and preserve the creativity of each generation.
Yeah, for us, it was, how do we track it? How do we track the rights? Like, how do I track all the, it was like really confusing. And then how do they get paid? It's like, oh my gosh, I know what a nightmare it is to do our reporting now. And I mean, we have another company that does AI for reporting for us, because they scour the world for who owns the song and all the publishers, all the songwriters. Mm-hmm. And that's a separate entity that we outsource but we have to feed all the data to them. And it still takes us 4 weeks to give them the data. And that's expensive. Now, can you imagine this thing blows up? Because I've done the blow up before. I mean, I know, like, when you get to 13 million users, that's a lot of data.
Well, you can't do that manually anymore.
No.
What would you say is the biggest challenge you're grappling with right now? I'm not trying to paint that as a negative or positive. Just what's consuming the most cycles for you right now? What are you pouring energy into these days?
Wow. You know, these white papers or light papers right now on the investment side. Right now, we're going through what's called an audit by a PCAOB. So it's a company that if you were going to go public, you would need to have your books done by an audit firm like this. We're getting the past 2 years of our audit done, and you have to go through everything, and it's rehashing everything. That's difficult. Our catalog on the karaoke side, it had a $14 million valuation of the catalog. Now it's $9 million, because that's all I can prove.
Okay.
They have to be able to, which is great. Still, it's a great asset for us, and we're going to grow it.
But now this is now becoming an investment grade asset.
Investment grade asset. That's where I need to bring it. I was going to do one of these token things and raise money, and I'm like, I just don't understand it, and which we may go into, but I need to go tried and true right now, what I know. And we haven't even talked to any banks yet, and two have already come out of the woodwork. We're doing a substantial raise, which would bring a lot of jobs to this area, like a lot of good jobs, especially in technology. I can't think of a better place to bring people when we love Knoxville.
Knoxville's emerging as a really, really hot place, especially for people that are emigrating from the West Coast.
Yeah.
From the Pacific Northwest and from the Northeast. Coming in here in droves because it's much cheaper to live here and it's nice.
Yeah, I mean the Zoom exodus really helped us because people are now used to it. I mean, we've been running a lot of virtual offices because the one fella, our visionary guy Charles, he's in New Jersey, Marcus is in York in the UK, I'm here, and we've always been talking virtually, through Zoom for the longest time. And for us now, the challenge now is cart horse, because I could come out with a light paper right now on a lot of these token things, and we could probably get in a bunch of money. I don't want to do that. It sounds crazy, but that would maybe be the wrong move and shooting ourselves in the foot. Once you create a decentralized autonomous organization, this is pretty much out of your hands. This thing is going to go off on its own.
Yeah. So if you create a DAO with smart contracts and you unleash the beast,
yeah,
it is what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you want to make sure you have your ducks in a row.
Yeah. All the tech in a row, because I want it to be developed out correctly.
Yeah. Got to have good bones. You got to have it written right in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely worth doing that before you do anything preemptive. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's painful because I see what we've created, and it really is a sea change. I mean, it really will transform. I hate the word disrupt. It's overused and it is disruptive.
Okay, I'm gonna say that you are legally allowed to use the term given the number of firsts that you brought to the table.
Yeah. Okay. So we would upset. We'll upset a lot. Like a lot of people get upset at us. Like before the pandemic, we presented at NAMM in National Association of Music Merchants. It's a big trade show for music equipment makers. And we were on the stage there with Doug DeAngelis from A3E. At the point, it wasn't called Creator at the time. It was called the Counterpoint Calculator. We're nerds. Counterpoint Calculator, right? A grammar checker for your counterpoint, which was valuable to us because if you're writing string sections or you're writing horn, wow, that speeds you up so much.
Sure.
And Doug illustrated that for us on stage. But it got to the point was, what do you think? Audience questions. I was like, you know, they were coming at us with pitchforks and torches because you have AI, they're going to take all our jobs. I was like, no, stop. Your jobs are already taken.
This is perhaps a way to claw back some legitimacy, some ownership.
I got a force multiplier for you here.
Yeah.
I'm going to empower you to make more money, to make more work. Because right now, streaming, I mean, you look at streaming industry and it's how many streams do you have? How much money are you making? I mean, you're not making that much money on these streams and you need a lot of them. I mean, the reason why the labels do well is because of their legacy catalog, because they're outliers, they're big hits like the Drakes of the world and the Lady Gagas. They'll pop up and, you know, they'll make them money that month, but they're tried and true. They're based.
It's like an 80-20. They're making most of their money off a very small piece of the pie. Yeah.
Well, the hits are getting people, but the back catalog, 87% of the money is coming in through the back catalog, all the old stuff, because there's a ton of it.
Yeah.
It's overwhelming how many songs there are written. To me, the AI empowers musicians and creatives. If you're working from your home studio, why go, they call music today. Yes, I'm a boomer. Music today is called beats. I'm finally okay with the term. I'm even okay with calling records vinyls now. Like, at first I got upset about it. I'm like, well, let's look at that. It's like, well, a new generation has adopted it and they've come up with their own nomenclature and let's be happy with that. Let's celebrate that because it survived. I mean, if it wasn't for millennials and the new kids on the block, vinyl would be gone. You know, we're lucky to live in Knoxville from the vinyl aspect of things. Sorry, I'm digressing into vinyl, but we have 6 record stores here. That's just great. You know, from the AI side of things, for that to give you that force multiplier for you to be able to create more music faster, you know, do a video game. You're going to need how many hours of music to do a video game? So our first interface is the Creator Pro, which does that.
We talked a lot about your sort of the stepping stones of your career. So I want to kind of just take it back to early childhood and mid-childhood. What were the things that led to you getting into that first band and into that first equipment sales and DJ position? What were the big stepping stones that put you there instead of being a rocket scientist, instead of going into a career in academia, instead of, you know, whatever?
You know, I was always pretty bright. I just was bored, like really bored a lot. It was like music was a lot of fun. In grade school, I remember my dad played drums. So I had the big old drumsticks and a pad, and I would always do Mama Papa, Paradiddle, and practice, you know. In the third grade, we had to do I think it was called the Seashore Sound Test or something like that back in 1967. It was a test I took in the third grade. And what instrument you can play. And he's handing me a trumpet, and I start crying. He goes, what? Mr. DeBlais, I've been playing the drums. Let me show you. And I showed him I could do a paradiddle and a roll. Gave me a set of drumsticks. Okay, took back the trumpet. Good.
Yeah.
And I started playing the snare in grammar school. And you got lessons every week, which was great. I don't think they do it in schools anymore. We got music lessons. Every kid took music lessons. And we got music lessons. And I got drumming lessons. Me and 5 other kids in the class. And the teacher would come in. I'm still friends with him. And he taught us the flutophone. And I just thought that was the coolest thing. And I played Battle Hymn of the Republic on the snare, our 6th grade assembly. And what a thrill that was. And I was like, I like that feeling. That was really nice. And I started playing the drums from there. And I was always interested, how do I record the drums? I got a tape recorder that Christmas of my 6th grade year. And I remember getting that reel-to-reel, portable reel-to-reel. It was like a little Nagra Mini, you know, and it was awesome. And I was able to record stuff on a microphone. I was recording everything. I would do little shows and all sorts of stuff on the tape. And it started from there. And I was the AV kid. I was the AV guy. I had the keys to the AV closet, you know. I used to show the films in school. And I did the same thing in high school. And then in college, I did AV. And
so that was all you volunteering to take on responsibilities and service of your organizations, but in return, you got access to equipment and environments and time that you were able to exercise.
Oh, check this out. I mean, I had the theater to myself. Everybody else was stuck in a study hall somewhere. I had backstage. I had the sound booth. I had keys.
You had power.
I had power. I used to go up in the loft and smoke cigarettes as a kid. Sorry, don't smoke. It's bad. I quit. It's like, it's hard to quit. It was great. You know, especially in junior high school. And then in high school, I didn't do the AV department because that wasn't cool at that point.
Yeah.
You know, you would probably got beat up or frowned upon. You would have been one of the nerds. And nerd wasn't cool back then. Now nerd is super cool, but back then it wasn't. And I started playing in bands. We had a high school band. I remember my freshman year, there was auditions at my friend Teddy Checkin's house. And I went over there. My friend Billy D'Amato, he made me go over there. Come on, come on. my nickname is Banjo. Banjo Jerry. A friend of mine had a speech impediment and ended up Banjo instead of Vanjo.
It stuck.
And it stuck. I mean, teachers would call Jim Isabella, Tommy Rosner, Banjo. I was a single, I was like Cher, single name. Throughout all of high school, I was Banjo. And even in my yearbook, it's Joe Banjo and Jerry. That was my beginning to all of it. AV, audio visual, and then sound, doing sound. I remember for our high school dance, we built our own lighting systems. I remember before it was Mackie, it was a company called Tapco. We had to build our own console for the boards to fit in, and we had to wire stuff up. We had to build a lot of stuff.
Man.
And we're recording on reel to reel.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about values and goals. Part of what this podcast is really about is how the interesting stories we've got around our work, how that really formed and how it aligns to our values and our goals. I know for a long time, I didn't really think about my values and goals actively, not consciously. They were just, mm-hmm. Just part of me that I grew over time. But I think stepping through consciously looking and thinking about your values is a really good exercise, especially when you've gone through life changes. You've been through a few.
Yeah.
Or lots of time has passed.
Yeah. Oh, well, for me, a lot of time has passed. There's more behind me than in front of me.
So can you sum up the values that you hold most dear? And you can be as general or specific as you like.
I get pretty heady about this part. I mean, because I think about it a lot. I've taken from the Dale Carnegie course with Sony to... Oh my God, I've done so many behavioral courses. And for me, it's almost like I wouldn't say a Taoist, because Taoist would be no purpose, right? It would probably be the opposite. Like it's the driving force, the purpose is to create something no one else is thinking about. Like really break new ground. Like that drives me. Do something so different. And like bring something to life, like the AI. And the reason why we went that way was because of rights, digital rights. And I was really looking at digital rights and how do we take this? How does it fare? You look at some of these older musicians like Muddy Waters and these guys who wrote this great stuff. You know, some nerve, these guys from England take your stuff, redo it. They do a whole lot of love and you don't own it. But it's your song. How do you fight that? I really believe it's a leveling. To me, the greatest thing I think I could do for mankind, I know it sounds lofty, but it really is lofty, is give a level playing field to artists. Because artists, and everyone says this, and I see this lip service everywhere, and I'm kind of rough around the edges. And when I say it, it's not like I probably don't have the Harvard degree, but what I do have is I have the work ethic behind it. I started off in it and I've worked my whole life in it. I was a songwriter as well and never did anything big because I wasn't really that good at the drums. Look, in retrospect, looking at really good drummers,
Sure.
But I was really good at the managing the side of it and organizing bands and so forth. And when I look at it today, it's like I think the purpose is to really give a level playing field to everyone. And I really believe that, blockchain really does a lot of that for us because it's an open ledger. Like everyone could see it. Everyone could see what the deal is. Everyone knows who contributed to it.
Right.
And we can track it all. And
there's no wizard behind the curtain.
No. And I don't want to talk badly about record labels either, because at the time that was it. Was Columbus a horrible guy? Yeah, absolutely. But at the time, when he did it, that's what was done. I mean, that's what record companies did. That's what I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying that's what was done at the time. I don't want to get canceled because I'm saying that. But it's the truth. That's what was done at the time. How do we change that, though? I could be mad at it all day long, but how do I change it? And that's why I want to change it. And I think that we're going to be a part of that change. The money? Sure, absolutely. Everybody wants to make money. Is that the thing that floats my boat? Partially, but no, I think it's a scorecard for lack of a better word. It's an achievement.
Sure.
Instead of
it's a leaderboard that tells you how you're doing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like how many pair of pants do I need? How many cars do I need to drive? I mean, it's like, really, I mean, how many, I think that's the biggest thing. And
So it sounds like a creation.
Yeah.
Right. Just the raw power of creation is a huge value for you. But also establishing a level playing field. making it fair for other creators, using your expertise, your knowledge, to create a system where everyone can play fairly.
Yeah, I was just talking to this one fellow who runs this hip-hop boulevard. It was out of the Bronx in New York. It's where hip-hop started, arguably. I look at a lot of these artists, these guys are broke again.
Right.
And everyone's using their templates.
Well, musical genius doesn't usually come with business acumen, right? And even if it did come with business acumen, it doesn't necessarily come with a self-perpetuating business model.
Correct.
And this is a way to sort of establish all that and let musicians just, or let creatives just be creatives.
That's the game plan. Yeah. It really is. I mean, I really believe that this year when we come out with it, it's going to be when I've seen this happen before. Like in my last company, we started off literally in a kitchen. And then by the time we were done, I was looking at, 160,000 square feet or something of space and 97 employees and warehouse distribution. And but now this in a virtual world, which is great because for us, we want to scale up and I need, real dev teams. Most of the developers today, they don't want to work for a company. They don't need to anymore.
Right.
They can just take a piece of the dev wallet, and be their own person. I mean, the great resignation is probably the greatest thing to happen in this country. Everyone's like freaking out about it. I'm like, no, this is wonderful. We're going to make stuff in America again. Like, it's going to happen. It's like, and look, it's not like make America great again kind of speech. It's just, why can't it just be done right here?
I think it's not so much the done right here as let's remove geography from where people do what they love to do.
Yeah.
Like, if you find a developer in South Asia, if you find a developer on the West Coast, why can't you work with them if you're all passionate about the same thing? You can now.
Oh, yeah. Through this whole pandemic, like, when the pandemic hit, we really lost, in the beginning of the pandemic, we lost 60% of our revenue. I had no money to pay anyone. I said, hey guys, I'm going to have meetings on Monday morning and on Thursday. If you want to show up on Zoom, great. My AI team showed up every Monday, every Thursday for the past 2 years. And we've been developing it out. We've had our heads down and just keep working. So I think it's a true group, belonging to a true group. And defining true group. Like,
well, tribes as a concept has come up again and again over the years.
Yeah.
And I think DAOs is going to be one really huge way of legitimizing this concept of tribe.
Yeah.
Of shared goals and ideals and values and shared effort and collecting and storing and saving that effort into something where you're all legitimately wired into legally. Like you have ownership of this DAO as a contributor to the DAO.
Yeah, my super goal is to develop out the bones and then to have someone replace me so I don't have to do it full time.
Right.
And it can continue. And I have my legacy.
Well, ideally, you don't have someone replace you. You have
multiple. That's right. Yeah.
You have pieces of code. You have smart contracts that replace the individual aspects of the roles of the things you were doing.
Correct.
Right? Let's write some software that does the vendor analysis that Joe does. Let's do the software that does the seeking out dollars, investment dollars, right? And how does it do that? Well, how does it do that? That's part and parcel of your software team's genius and your genius.
Yeah, so absolutely. And then when you go out to raise money now, everyone's looking at you as if you're the thing. And I'm like, no, I'm just, I'm the vessel yapping right now. That's essentially what it is. Yeah, I figured out how to put all these guys together. Yes, I figured all of that out. That's wonderful. But like, this is the group that's doing it. And like, we need more of that group. That group needs to grow bigger. And this is what we're laying the table for. We're setting the table for that. And I think we're in pretty good shape right now with Digitrax to take this software out. And I'm getting pretty jazzed about it.
You've got a lot done in your life. I have to wonder, do you have some systems? Do you have any rituals that you have that help with your success?
Oh, absolutely. You got to write everything down. First of all, I like to use a verb for it as opposed to a noun, an organizing board. As instead of an organizational chart, it's it's alive. This thing is alive, and it changes all the time. It's always changing by virtue. It has to. It's just always morphing, right? I do that, and I have I call it a battle plan. And I every morning I write down all of the things that I have to do. First thing. Well, actually, the very first thing I do is I clear my head and I play a record in the morning, and I take a picture of the album cover and I research the album, and then whatever I recall from knowing about the record. And I try my writing skills every morning. And I'm a horrible writer, and I always try to get better at writing. It's something that you can work at. And that's what I've been working at. Like recently, I want to become a good short story writer. And that's what I work at. And that clears my head in the morning. And then I'll work out first thing. Like I'll go, we do resistance training at the house. We've got a little gym in the basement. And then after that, I'll sit down and do my battle plan. And then I see what I need to accomplish, short-term goal, medium-term goal, long-term goals. And I originally started with the Franklin Planner. I don't know if you remember that way back when.
And then it became Franklin Covey.
Yeah. And I think that was instilled in me at a young age. I've always done that. I used to carry my Franklin Planner with me all the time. I always had it in my pocket and I would write it. Now I have it on my phone. I have two things. One are targets and goals. Target is must have to eat. That's a target. Goal is that lofty thing that I really want to do. And every morning I look at it pops up on my targets and goals will pop up every morning. And I read my major targets and goals first. But it comes up every day. And I look at those. They're helpful. And then planning, 80% planning, 20% execution, and then execute, like really execute. The pandemic's been a real curveball, though. It's just like psychologically, mentally, it's been tough. I mean, it's, tough on everybody, but it's really been tough. It's hard to hold it together, especially when you really want to help a lot of people. And my help button is huge. Like, if somebody needs help, I'll jump right in and get in there and try and do stuff. But especially with musicians, because they're so abused.
Before we sign off, is there any place in particular that you'd like to send people to find out more about you and what you're into?
You can look at my LinkedIn page. It's Joseph Vangieri. I'm on LinkedIn. You could look at creator.com, kr38r.com.
Thank you so much, Joe. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did.
I love chatting, so thanks for acknowledging. That's why I like talking.
To be honest, the podcast thing that I started last year, and it was partly I was in a deficit of personal one-to-one connection, right? Mm-hmm. I needed more connection. But it was also, I realized that I enjoyed this format of just learning about what people had done before, what they're doing now. How did they get here? What led them here? That's an interesting story to me. And I thought maybe that would resonate with a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, it does.
I hope this episode finds someone out there at just the right time in their own life. Maybe you're thinking of switching careers, picking up an instrument, recording an album. Maybe the idea of democratizing music on the blockchain really strikes a chord. Speaking of listeners, to you fine folks out there, the only thing I ask is that if you're enjoying this episode, if this talk about how we end up in our roles is interesting to you, please leave a review on your platform of choice. And like us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Every bit of exposure helps us find more ears. Thanks so much, and until next time, stay focused on your why.